You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is the fastest growing app for hunters, fishermen, fisherwomen, outdoor enthusiasts of all kinds. Now, it's similar to Facebook and it's similar to Instagram, but one big thing: you're not going to get criticized for posting your harvest pictures or posting your love of guns. These are things that are common on Go Wild because it is dedicated to the outdoor community, the hunters, the fishers, the outdoor enthusiasts of all kinds. It's a place for us to come together as a community and really appreciate the outdoors. And I think you guys are really going to like this. So for more information, visit timetogowild.com or go to wherever you currently download your apps and check out Go Wild today.
Welcome to show number 14. This is a really cool show. I think everybody's going to enjoy it. Before we get started, I want to remind everybody to send me in their hunting stories. I've been receiving a bunch of them so far. I've got a bunch of awesome archery stories that I've been going through. Can't wait to see more of those, and I can't wait to start seeing some rifle stories after rifle season. I've been receiving them through the website. I've gotten a couple on Instagram, direct message, and several on Facebook Messenger. So there's plenty of ways to get them to me. If you want to record a video, send me a video. If you want to record an audio file, send me an audio file. And however you can get me the story, just get me the story so that we can get a couple of winners selected. And then if you haven't been listening and you don't really know what you win, my favorite archery story and my favorite rifle story will both be guests that come on the podcast, and they'll have the opportunity to tell their story. They also, each one will win a 1 month Mountain Hunter box, a 1 year premium membership to Onyx Maps, and a $250 gift card in the Go Hunt store. All of those are really, really good products. If you're not tracking the Mountain Hunter box, Derek over there puts out a really good quality product every month. Of course, Onyx is the best mapping system that I've found. I just got back from my hunt, and I used Onyx every single day, at least 100 times a day. I tracked all of my routes. I did everything with Onyx Maps. Scouting, everything on the ground was Onyx Maps. And then in the Go Hunt store, you'll find nothing but the best products. The guys at Go Hunt, they test every product before they even think about putting it in their store. So everything that they use is tried and true, good quality stuff. So a lot of good products there. I'm working with a couple other companies too to try to get some other things added to the products for the winners. So it should be a pretty good deal. Keep them stories coming in. Like I said, that's what I want. I want to read about other hunters, and I want to hear other hunter stories. And I'm excited to get those people on whenever we select them. Now, as far as selection goes, it's not just me that's doing this. I've got a couple of other friends of mine that are in the hunting community that are going to help me narrow it down. So it's not just a biased opinion from myself. There'll be three of us that choose the final winners. So keep them stories coming. I really appreciate it. I love hearing about it. So keep them coming. And with that said, here we go. Dan Salzman. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Rookies in the Backcountry podcast. I'm really excited about today's show. I have Dan Salzman on, and if you haven't heard of Dan, make sure you check him out on Instagram. Jump over there. He's got tons of good pictures. But Dan is an absolute elk killer in the mountains. We're going to get into it in a little bit, how successful he's been and some of the reasons why he's been so successful and how he's been so successful. But up to this point, Dan's been killing elk in Idaho, and he's 5 for 5 right now. So first off, congratulations on that, Dan. I know you just killed a bull a week ago, week ago. Is that right?
A little longer than that. August 31st. So my first August pull this year.
Okay. Awesome. So
first day in the woods this year.
Yeah. First day in the woods, and he put one on the ground. Like I said, we're going to get in. We're going to talk about his hunts and all of that stuff. But I want to let him introduce himself, and then we're going to talk about some of the transition that, Dan made from hunting the whitetail out in Pennsylvania and then making that move to Idaho. So with that, Dan, if you want to talk about some of your background and, just introduce yourself, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Letting me on. Yeah, so you got my name. I'm 33. I think that sounds right. I forget sometimes. Father of four little kids, husband. Been out here in Idaho 8 years, just hit 8 years. So didn't elk hunt the first couple of years, but got into it after being out here and kind of getting the lay of the land and doing some other stuff for a few seasons, and then decided to dive in. So from Scranton, Pennsylvania originally, grew up out there hunting whitetails and turkeys, and that's about it. Totally different ball game. So I've got the switching from East Coast to West Coast kind of down now.
Do you ever get the chance to go back to hunt whitetail?
Well, I've hunted, I've taken 4 or 5 Idaho whitetails.
Okay.
I just haven't been back to Pennsylvania. So
okay, gotcha.
We've got some up here, up north. So we've got some good bucks. Killed a couple out here. So I still have the itch for whitetail hunting, man. I think if you grew up with it, it's kind of hard to shake it. No matter how into the elk and mule deer I get, I still got a soft spot for whitetails. So,
just real quick, do you hunt whitetails in Idaho the same that you hunt them in Pennsylvania? Is it tree stand and hunting over water in a blind and that kind of stuff, or is it spot and stalk?
So the whitetail hunts that I've done here have been late season, mid-November rifle hunts. So I can block out, a week of vacation and just drive up north, and it's a little different. So we couldn't be choosers growing up hunting whitetails because we were beggars most of the time for a spot to go. So hunting small tracts of private land, 4 or 5 guys on 30 acres, it was kind of, you had one spot where you could sit and you sat there no matter what, and you got 1 week of the year to do it. So you just went and found the best place you could and sat there for a week straight. So there wasn't really much tactics involved. It was kind of luck of the draw and who pushed a deer in front of somebody else, who got up to stretch their legs first and bump some deer to the other guy. So yeah, it was definitely more strategic out here, kind of doing some online scouting, figure out, they migrate out here a little bit when the snow starts to fall. So figuring out kind of patterns where deer are going to go and, where the terrain's going to funnel them and stuff like that. So it's a little more interesting out here.
I'm sure everything's more interesting out there. You add mountains to anything and I think it changes the dynamic.
Yeah. It's just something about climbing around in the hills too in a foot of snow and shooting a buck too. Kind of unbeatable.
So the first couple years you were in Idaho, you didn't hunt. What was that transition? Was that you just didn't have time for it?
We moved out here in August, the end of August, and Idaho requires you to be here for a year before you can gain residency. So in order for me to hunt the first season I was out here, I would have had to bought non-resident tags, which we just couldn't afford at the time. My wife and I came out here with kind of just what was on our backs and landed and got a roof over our heads. And, that was about all we could do to keep food in the fridge. So couldn't shell out the $400 or $500 for a non-resident deer tag that year. So I just kind of stood by on that one. And then the following year I started hunting again. I got invited from some guys that she worked with to go up north and hunt whitetails. And I said, absolutely. And, went up there and shot a nice buck, killed a 5x6 whitetail up there. And actually that second year of the, opening day of archery season, I shot my first mule deer. I shot a doe with my bow just because after not hunting the year before, I had to put some meat in the freezer. So
nothing wrong.
So I got two. No, nothing wrong with that at all. No. I'd make that decision again in a heartbeat after sitting out for a year. So
yeah.
So yeah, I got two deer that year. And then the next year I did the same thing. I shot a muley buck down here and then bought a non-resident tag and went up north, shot a whitetail. And then I think the year after that, I shot a mule deer down here with my bow. I went up there, shot a whitetail buck with a rifle. And then I actually drew an extra antlerless tag, so I got to shoot a doe up there too. So I started stacking some deer up pretty good, and figured after a couple of years of doing that, that there was these great big animals that called elk, where if I killed one of those, it would be about the equivalent of three deer. So I could maximize my efficiency and just focus on elk. So that's kind of what I did.
When you started getting into elk hunting and looking at elk hunting, what sort of resources did you use that helped you learn the land and kind of how and where to hunt?
Randy Newberg's platform, the Hunt Talk forums, were awesome. When I first started out, I could go there and, you know, ask guys questions and just read stories of guys' hunts and what was working for other guys. And Corey Jacobson had a DVD out at the time called The Elk University, kind of like what he does now with the online program, but it was just a DVD that I could watch over and over again, and had some pretty basic stuff. You know, they didn't dive too deep into anything, but, you know, the basics of e-scouting and what to look for in habitat, and, you know, the key components, a little bit of calling. And then I stumbled into Paul Madel's stuff, The Elk Nut, who's an absolute treasure trove of knowledge when it comes to elk. And just called him up on the phone one day and started asking some questions, ordered some of his DVDs, started learning a lot about calling, you know, trying to put the whole piece of the puzzle together. But the biggest thing was, I think once I started to figure out that a lot of the groundwork could be done online and on the computer, and really putting a game plan together from home so that when I got a weekend that I could go out and actually look around, you know, I wasn't just wandering around. I had a plan and knew what I was looking for, and already had some spots that I could either check off the list or circle and come back to.
So are you willing to share some of those secrets that you have? Like when you do your e-scouting, it's sort of how you plan and, you know, put all that together?
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe walk me through, like, if you're going to sit down, you're looking at a new unit, how are you planning to get into that unit, and what are the things that you're looking for?
Okay, so the first thing I do is I'll throw an actual big paper map out on the floor. I know it's e-scouting is the big glamorous thing, but I like to get a kind of a big overview of the whole unit. You can do it on the computer too, but something about just doing it on an actual paper map is easier for me to keep track of. And what I'll do there is just look for the biggest roadless areas within that unit, and elk go where they go, but typically the spots where there aren't roads through, you know, every half a mile tend to hold the most elk, in at least in my experience. So I'll kind of start by just making broad circles. Okay, this general area, you know, is 20 square miles without a road, and just go through and circle all of them. And then I'm kind of breaking it down, you know, and I'll say I've got five or six of those in a unit. Then within those, I'll break it down to the next step. I'll go online. The Idaho Fish and Game website is a great resource. They have a tool called the Interactive Hunt Planner Map Center. I think the state of Colorado has something real similar. There's a couple of Western states that have something pretty similar to this. And you can do all this stuff on GoHunt. A lot of these tools are on Onyx if you have those subscriptions. Within those spots, I'll put on the trail layer, like I said, and just make sure. Because a lot of times roads that don't show up on the paper map, you know, they'll come up as ATV and dirt bike trails and stuff like that on the computer. So just making sure, verifying what I saw on the map was right and that there isn't roads and motorized trails through it. Then from there, I'll kind of figure out if there's long stretches, big canyons with north-facing timber, open south-facing slopes where it looks like there'd be feed, you know, and not rock fields, but, you know, good grassy areas for elk to graze in. And then water, you know, in the bottom of the canyon or nearby within a few miles where elk could easily travel to get to it. So just kind of checking things off the list there. And then I'll turn on the satellite layer. I do all this pretty much on topos, and then I'll turn on the satellite layer and, you know, really try to get a feel for what the ground cover looks like.
And is that in Google Earth when you're doing that?
I can do all this on the Idaho Fish and Game website just because it's all in one spot.
Okay.
But then I'll go back and forth between Google Earth too, because you can't get a 3D view on the Idaho Fish and Game website. Everything is straight from above. So you get a better feel of what the terrain actually looks like on Google Earth.
Okay.
So I kind of go back and forth between the two. And then, my paper maps are rugged maps, I use, they're called. So they've got past burn data on them too. So we've got the outlines of all the old fires. So if I can put all those pieces together, and then, you know, it's a bonus that if there's a burn throughout there, I don't like to get locked into one big giant burn, but if I can hunt fringes or the edges of an old burn where that good feed is going to be, then that's definitely something that draws my attention too.
That sounds very similar to the Randy Newberg method.
Yeah. Yeah, Randy's the master. He's I still am baffled when I hear him talk about e-scouting. That guy takes it to a whole new level. So I'm sure if you can pry more secrets out of him, that'd be the way to go. But from there, I'll even take it a step further. Like, so I might have four or five places that I really want to key in on, and then I pick up the phone and I'll call Idaho Fish and Game and ask to talk to a wildlife biologist, and then ask them specific questions about the area. You know, like, is there an outfitter that typically runs drop camps in that canyon or in that area? Is the wolf pressure known to be bad in there? You know, are there typically elk in there? What is the pressure like? You know, which direction do guys typically come in from if there's a road close by? So I'll just have a list of questions and specific areas to ask them about. And a lot of times they won't say, you know, yes, that's a great area, go there. But they might give you a hint, you know, or say, you know, you might want to look a canyon north of there, or you might want to avoid this area because typically you can either, you know, put a big star next to something on their advice or cross it off the list if they tell you that there's, you know, a ton of guys coming in from maybe a spot that you didn't think of. So,
yeah, that's good advice. I've had a couple of conversations with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife guys, and they've been pretty helpful when you get on the phone with them. And when you got to kind of show them that you know what you're talking about a little bit, like you've done the research.
Exactly.
And when I think initially it always seems they're real standoffish, like they don't want to talk to you. But when you let them know that you have done that research and you know, they just seem to open up a little bit more when you're talking actual roads and canyons and creek names, and, you know, mm-hmm. they just seem to work with you a little better. So,
yeah. So the first time I called, I totally bombed. I got somebody on the phone and fell on my face. Didn't remember anything that I was going to say. So now I'll have the map in front of me. And typically it takes two or three times to get somebody. So if you call and they say they're out in the field, and these people aren't, they're not in the office much. So leave a message. Just like, I'll have my maps and stuff and all my notes in the glove box of my truck. So when they call me back at 2 p.m. and I'm at work, I can throw everything out on a table somewhere and talk when they have time to talk. So just be aware of that too. And then I'll have a list of, you know, all the spots that I was thinking of, what my questions were and everything. So once I have them on the phone, I'm not, you know, at a loss and let them off too early without getting the info that I need.
Yeah. Yeah. That's happened to me before too. You hang up with them and you're like, dang it. I still had like four or five questions, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. And then you call back and they don't answer. And then it's voicemail. And
yeah. And the season starts before they get back to you.
Yep.
Yep.
So yeah, agreed. It sounds like you've definitely nailed that down on keeping all your maps and everything with you. So,
Yeah, I only made that mistake once. Luckily.
Let's go back to your first elk hunt, if you don't mind, if you can remember back that far. I have trouble going back a year or two, so we'll see how good you are at going back 5 years. But do you kind of remember any of those, like the anticipations and the anxieties and expectations that you had for that first elk hunt?
I do. I didn't really know what to expect, so it was my first backpack hunt. It was my first kind of big endeavor, you know, other than, so I'd done week-long whitetail hunts, but it was driving in and out every day, sleeping in a cabin at night, you know, having a full kitchen to cook yourself dinner, and you're comfortable. You can dry your clothes out. You know, you're really not out of your comfort zone that much. So going from that into I took a 9-day stretch to bivy out for elk in the mountains in October was a totally different ball game. So I was definitely nervous going into it. Wasn't really sure what to expect.
Did you have any hunting buddies that you went with, or anybody that could kind of guide you through it?
So I had another Air Force buddy. He came out with me. He didn't have a tag, and he hadn't really done it before either. But you know, he had a ton of experience just being out, mostly all military stuff. But just a good, confident guy to have around, and I knew would have my back in case anything went wrong out there. So, but no, he didn't really have any backpack hunting experience either. So we were both kind of learning trial by fire out there. Just all my gear was new and untested, just, you know, buying everything based off other people's reviews and trying my best to piece stuff together, which I'm sure a ton of guys know the feeling of coming from, you know, back east or the Midwest out here to do a big Western hunt for the first time.
Yeah, I certainly know that feeling, but I've actually spent a lot of time in all of my gear and with all of my gear. So that's been really helpful to me. And I think that was a pointer that I have put out a few times, was test everything you've got and get out there. And like, I started out in a certain kind of camouflage, yep, wearing a certain kind of pants. And as I did two or three, hikes with my pack on, and the pants didn't fit right. It's, you know, and I just had to start changing things up until I figured out what was comfortable. So that was a learning curve.
Yep. Yeah. So I was, had my hunting boots on and my pack on with my daughter in my pack, and was going for walks around the block to break my boots in. You know, I was out here and in Idaho, but you know, the spot that I hunted that first year was about a 6-hour drive away. So I couldn't really get up there, and I didn't really know anywhere else, because all the spots I'd been hunting were, you know, 7 or 8 hours north of here. So I was kind of doing the same things. Even though I was here, I was still trying to put all the pieces together without actually being out there and in the areas I was going to hunt in.
Well, that's good. I think anywhere you can try anything out is better than nothing. You know, for me, I know, like, yeah, around, sure, around here where I'm at, I don't have mountains or anything. I'm in San Antonio, Texas. So the best I can do is the hill country up northwest of town. But if I go out and I've got my backpack on and I got my boots on, I don't just walk on the sidewalk. I always walk in the side ditches to where I could practice like side hilling and, you know, just kind of work in the different terrain instead of just cruising along on a sidewalk. So that helped me a lot, I think. Well, we'll see. I don't know for sure yet, but.
I'm sure it will. It's better than anytime you can make things, you know, as close to game time scenario as possible. It's definitely going to help you out.
Yeah,
for sure.
Good. So do you still get any of those same anxieties when you go hunting? Is it still that first time out feeling, or are you a lot more comfortable now?
I do if I'm alone. I still get some anxiety and stuff if I'm, you know, doing solo overnighters, which I think is normal. I think you should kind of have a healthy respect, if not bordering on a little a little fear is good. Probably stops me from doing things that are stupid. You know, I got kids to feed at home, so I can't be out there, you know, climbing knife ridges at 10,000 feet and doing crazy stuff by myself. So yeah, I think that's normal and probably somewhat healthy. As far as just feeling, you know, overwhelmed by the amount of space and how big the country is out here and what to do, I think that kind of goes away with time. You get a better feel for, you know, how far things are, you know, actually are, and what you're capable of and where you can get to and what, you know, accomplish in a day of hunting. I think that you get a way better sense of that after a couple of trips.
Good point. So how's your, so far your 2018 season, how's everything going?
So far, so good. Got that bull down. First day in the woods in Idaho after we tried to get in opening day, and we tried to go in the night before opening day, actually. and one of my buddies, his four-wheeler broke down, so we take a trail in, a motorized trail, and then hike out from there. Well, that plan didn't work, so we wound up packing everything up in the trucks and taking a three-hour drive around till about 1 in the morning to a new spot. And we were going to hike into this non-motorized spot where we could all get in. And we started hiking in there, and we got about a mile from the truck. And the same buddy decided he didn't want to come anymore. He was done. I don't know what that was about, but so we said, okay, man, you know, go do your thing. Like, you know, we got some elk to kill. So he took off, and we decided, well, now we can go back to our other original spot, you know. And so loaded everything up, made the drive back around, just because it was a better area where we could play multiple days instead of just being into that walk-in spot for that one, that doing day hunts out of a walk-in spot where we could be in, packed in for a couple days at a time, made more sense. So we got loaded up and started going back around, and we got almost all the way back around, and my buddy's truck broke down. His alternator went out on his truck, so wound up having to jump him and then or bring him into the closest town to get jumper cables and then jump him and then try to figure out how to get everything into my truck. So three trucks pulling or three dirt bikes and all our coolers and gear and totes full of stuff, and then pulling my pop-up camper, which we popped up and loaded full of stuff and then put back down. So it was a bit of a cluster, but we managed to overcome and get in there. Get up there right at last light of opening day. So the second day of the season was our first day of hunting, more or less.
That first night sounds like a long night.
Yeah, it was. I was not a happy camper.
Yeah, I bet.
it's crazy to wait all year long for opening day and then have it just, you know, stuff like that blow up in your face. But just got to keep a positive attitude and know that, you know, sometimes stuff happens for a reason. Who knows why we weren't supposed to be in there that night, but, you know, it worked out, and we had a bull on the ground at noon the next day. So
awesome. Very, very good.
Yep. You can always overcome. Just, you know, make the most of the time you have, more or less.
Did your buddy get one too?
My buddy that took off, he went back to Montana. And I'm heading out this weekend to try to get my other buddy, Mike, that was with us, try to get him a bull. So we're going back into the same spot, see if we can get lightning to strike in there again, because it's usually, I mean, there was a lot more bulls in there, so that's the plan.
Cool. Do you only hunt archery, or do you also go rifle hunt?
I do rifle hunt. I'm an opportunist, you know. Okay. I liked archery hunt more, but I have nothing against the rifle. So, but in Idaho, if you buy an archery tag, you have to pick, basically. So you have to pick a zone, and then within that zone, which hunt you're going to do. So I just picked my zone and then archery. So most of the rifle hunts are draws anyway. So I can pretty much guarantee myself an over-the-counter archery elk hunt every year. So,
and then when is Oregon? When are you heading out there?
Yeah, so I went out there. Their season opens before ours. So I went out for 4 days before our season opened, and then drove back through and then started hunting Idaho. So got into some elk, covered a ton of country. Could have shot cows and spikes pretty much almost every day of the 4 days that I was out there, and just was holding out for a branch antlered bull. So hopefully if Mike tags out this weekend, then next weekend we'll be back over in Oregon trying to fill that tag.
And is that... You said this is your first year out in Oregon, right?
It is.
Okay.
So
go ahead.
I just learned that this year that Oregon does they do resident pricing for people who are actively serving in the military.
Really?
Yeah. So my Oregon, this is a secret that a lot of people probably aren't going to want me to give out, but yeah. So my Oregon hunting license and elk tag combined was like, I don't know. It was I got a deer tag, an elk tag, and a hunting license. So it was like $112.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'd kind of be crazy not to take advantage of that every year, as long as I'm still in. So
I'm going to have to remember that for next year. That's one of the only states that does that, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think Texas does it too, maybe.
Well, Texas...
There's a couple of...
Texas is... If you live here, everything's free. Your tags and everything are free. One of the other cool things that I learned... Sorry, this is kind of a tangent, but for people listening... if you are stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas, which is in El Paso, you can get resident... You get free Texas hunting licenses for everything. Mule deer, all their waterfowl and all that stuff. And you also get resident pricing for New Mexico. So you get both. Really? Yeah, you get both states. Because half of Fort Bliss...
Nice.
Half of Fort Bliss falls in New Mexico. So they give you both. So yeah, that's a little tip there too. So...
So you'll be putting in for a BOP to over to Fort Bliss?
Right. Yeah, well, I just came from Fort Bliss, actually, but it was kind of before the big game bug got, well, not big game, but just elk got a hold of me. I would love to go back. I love Fort Bliss, but anyway, that's a whole nother topic. So,
Well, there are some states out there that do that. So anybody who's in the military and looking to put a hunt together, look into it. Call the state wildlife agency, whatever it is, and ask. It's worth checking out.
Yeah. So of your five elk that you've gotten, what's been your favorite hunt that you've done so far?
Man, I've tried to formulate an answer for this that made sense, and I just can't. they're all my favorite, because there's just a different story to all of them. You know, they all mean something different. You know, it's the first one is awesome, and I worked my tail off for my first, you know, the first bull, and then there's the first archery bull. It's a unique story and something that I wouldn't trade. So, yeah, I don't know where I'd go with this, man. They're all pretty special to me.
Yeah, and you would say,
I guess I'll have to find something else to do when they stop being, you know, fun, meaningful hunts. So.
Well, I think that's probably the best answer that you could have come up with, honestly. Because before we started the show, we were talking a little bit, and you were saying that every hunt that you've done has been in a different unit in a different area in Idaho. So I'm sure that each one of them is unique and in some sort of way and has its own character.
It does, for sure. You know, so it's like last year was me and Mike's first year hunting together. So getting to kill a bull with him and you know, doing the pack out in the dark and tripping and falling and getting all beat up, you know, it's just the stuff that sucks while you're doing it is always the stuff you look back on fondly. So, and then, you know, this year missing opening day completely, and then, you know, having that, it was our, we literally got out of the mountain, figured out maybe where some elk might've been bedding, did one calling setup, didn't get anything moving. We moved probably 200 yards, did another calling setup, and a bull came in and it was shot at, you know, noon on the first day. So it was just like every experience is totally unique and awesome in its own way. So I got to stop shooting bulls opening weekend though, because it's a long month after that.
Yeah, I bet. Well, at least you get to go out and help your buddies. And
yeah, that is true. I owe Mike one, so. He's had to watch me shoot two on opening weekends the last 2 years. And then, so this is the year. We're going out this weekend with a purpose. He's got a dedicated caller, and hopefully we get it on film again.
Yeah, so. Good. So I got pretty lucky, too. We've got it was me and a buddy of mine from back in the Midwest and meeting up in Colorado. And we picked up a third guy who lives in Colorado just through mutual friends and you know, just happened to be that this guy wanted to go hunt with us, and he killed a really nice bull last weekend. So he's still going to meet up with us and go out and call for us and help us pack out meat if we get something. So that's
perfect.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think, cause he could have easily said, nope, I got my bull on the ground. I'm done. I'm not going anymore, but he just wants to be out in the woods. And, so it works out cool. I think that's great about the hunting community, that people are always willing to just go help out.
Yeah, it's always nice to have an extra back and set of legs, too, when there's a bull on the ground.
Yeah.
Or a cow on the ground, or any elk, for that matter. It's nice to have that's when the extra guys really come in handy.
Yeah, we'll see. I hope we'll see how it goes for us.
Yeah.
But So before we get off of here, I wanted to kind of circle back and talk about some of your gear. I wanted to talk about maybe like that first year that you went out, the pack that you started out with, just sort of what boots did you have on your feet, and then what transition have you made up until now? Like, you know, the importance of good quality gear versus something, or if you've got any tips or tricks that you could share.
Yeah, sure. So, I had my gear list, I think, fairly dialed. I haven't really taken a ton of stuff out. I know you hear a lot of stories about guys bringing things that seem ridiculous after a while, but I had so much time. I decided a full year earlier that I was going to start doing this backpack hunt. So before I even got out in the woods, I was realizing, okay, you know, I don't need this, I don't need that. So it's just a matter of kind of upgrading everything over the past couple of years. So I started out with an Army Surplus bivy sack, you know, the four-piece Army sleep system.
Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar.
I'm sure you're familiar with.
Very familiar. I think they sewed lead weights into that thing.
Yeah, so my I had the Wiggies GIs, you know, sleeping bag. It was like 6 pounds. And then that Gore-Tex bivy sack, which is, like you said, it's – so, I mean, my bag and that bivy sack, I was probably at 10 pounds.
Wow.
Which is like more than double where I'm at now for everything. So, I started with an Alps, I think it was the Commander, they call it. So it's a pack frame with a removable bag, kind of clips onto it. They still sell them. Sportsman's Warehouse carries them. They're like $129, and it worked great for my first elk hunt. You know, it's a good pack until you had other stuff on your back and realize there's better stuff out there, but it'll get the job done. And at that price point, I don't think you can really beat it. So,
okay.
Solid bargain pack.
Yeah. So that's a good pack for somebody they're doing a one-time elk hunt once in their life and probably never going again. That's a good budget way to go then, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if the frame I still have. I use the frame for hauling in barrels and bear bait and stuff like that, but the bag kind of fell apart after one season. So I run an XO Mountain Gear now. I have for the past, this is my third or fourth year with it, same bag. It's packed out a bunch of elk and deer and bear and other stuff. So if you've got the money, that's the way to go. That's my recommendation, but there's a plenty of bags in between that'll get the job done.
Yeah, I just got my XO not too long ago.
I saw that.
Yeah,
congrats.
Yeah, thanks.
It's a big move.
It was. Well, I had a good pack before. I was running a Kuyu pack, and I just really like the guys over there and at XO, and I just like that community. And Jeremy Ansel, who I think you also know, has the XO Mountain Gear page on Facebook, and everybody's so helpful on there. And I don't know, it just seemed like what I wanted more than the Kuyu. So I love that thing.
So funny story, when I was shopping, I really wanted to upgrade and get a good top of the line pack. That's the two that I had it narrowed down to, was a Kuyu Icon and an XO. I called Kuyu and started asking questions. Just got, you know, kind of a sales lady who didn't really know. I don't really think she understood what I was getting at. Maybe didn't use the pack. And then I called the XO and got Steve.
Yeah, that's and, that's the difference right there. Definitely.
That was it. And they were local. And, Steve, you know, he said, hey, look, if you break this thing, we'll fix it for you. Come down here. I told him, I said, I don't have any money to buy the pack right now. I'm just trying to figure it out. He said, well, come down here and go on a hike with us and I'll loan you one. And we'll get it loaded up and you can try it out. You know, just so helpful and accommodating and so proud of what they were making. I was like, man, this is the way to go. So,
yep, that's kind of it's exactly the way I felt about them too. So I made that switch. And my Icon's a big 5200. So it's still here, but my XO's a 3500, and I've got it's packed up right now and it's ready to go. I could easily get 7 days out of that thing, no problem, with 3500. So,
yep, same here. That's what I'm still running, the 35.
their 55 might be easier to get everything in, but I made it work in the 55 or the 35. So
yeah. So my theory on that was, if I bought a 55 and I had room, I would start packing things that I didn't really need.
Yeah.
So I bought the smaller bag on purpose, knowing that I would have to force myself to be more efficient and, you know, be more aware of what I was taking with me. So.
Right. Right. What other upgrades have you made?
I don't know if it's an upgrade, but I've run a different pair of boots every year for the last 5 years. So I have really wide flat feet, and anybody who's followed me for a while has probably seen some of the foot issues that I've had on the death hike this year.
I was going to say, you destroyed your feet on the death hike.
Yeah, so that's been kind of an ongoing struggle. Started with Loas, then went to Zamberlin's, and then what did I wear last year? I don't even remember, but I've pretty much had everything, all the top up Kenitrex. I'm running Crispies this year, and so far I really like them. I've been wearing the Summit GTX. They're a lighter mid-height boot. It's not the typical mountain style full leather upper. It's a Cordura. It's got Cordura panels on the side, so it's a little lighter, a little more breathable, and it's really working out for me so far. So. And they're not crazy expensive either, which is nice.
And what were you wearing on the death hike?
I wore my Ultra Timp trail running shoes.
Okay.
Which are a great trail running shoe. I just think it was kind of a worst case scenario for my feet and the terrain we were going over and to be wearing them. I just, you know, just as much off trail type stuff as there was and as much water. I think it was just a boot would have been a better choice. So I did wear some, I wore some Salomons that a buddy loaned me for the third day and wore those for the last 25 miles or whatever. And things got better and not worse. So, and a ton of guys wear those Salomons and really like them.
That's what I'm in the 4D GTXs.
Yeah. Yep. So the only knock I've heard on those is they're not very durable. Guys tend to only get a season out of them or maybe two, but at the price, I mean, you can replace them and not, you know, not be too far out of whack money-wise.
Yeah. What do you do for a tent?
So this year I'm rocking a Jimmy Tarps Hudson Teepee.
Okay.
So it's a 9'4" square footprint, and that's like, I think it stands like 54 inches tall in the middle, so it's not a full height teepee. You can't stand in it, but you can sit up and put your clothes and tie your boots on and all that stuff, which is really convenient. The last couple of years I've run real small, either single or two man shelters, and just you don't have any room for your pack or for moving around, get dressed in the morning. And so with this, I can run a stove in it too, into the later season stuff.
Nice.
Yeah. So I haven't done it yet, but I think the stove might come out this weekend. We've got a bit of cold weather here the last couple of days. So
what's that?
Itching to break it out.
What's that Jimmy Tarp weigh?
It's 18 ounces.
Okay. Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. And with, so that's just with the fabric. It's a single trekking pole pitch in the center, and then you've got to stake it out, obviously. So you add a little weight with the stakes, but if you're carrying trekking poles anyway, which most guys are, you know, you're not gaining any weight for carrying tent poles there, which is nice.
Yeah.
So, and it'll sleep. You could squeeze four guys into it, but it'll hold three guys in everybody's packs real comfortably.
And with the stove too?
That we haven't done it with the stove yet.
Okay.
Three guys side by side, and then you could put a fourth guy across everybody's feet or everybody's heads, depending on how you were oriented within there. But I think with two guys and all your gear and a stove would be pretty much ideal.
Okay.
You know, the third guy's real small, maybe.
Yeah.
You can squeeze. I tell you, I'd rather be in there with two other guys than be outside. So I think you could make it work with three guys.
Exactly.
Yep.
Any other pieces of gear, equipment that you think is absolutely necessary for people to take, somebody to have, something that you just won't go without?
Yeah, pretty much standard stuff, man. You got to have a pair of binos. I don't bring spotting scope elk hunting or a tripod typically. Just because I figure if I can, you can spot elk from a couple miles away with 10 power binos. And if it's a branch antlered bull, it looks good enough for me to go over and take a closer look at it. So
yeah.
I'm not worried about picking things apart with a spotting scope on an elk hunt.
What binos do you run?
I am still running. I think that's pretty much the only thing I haven't upgraded. I'm still running Vortex Diamondbacks.
Okay.
I think this will be the year after this season where I'm going to dump some cash on some Swaros and bite the bullet and have the same pair of binos for the next 20 years, But
it's a tiny little upgrade there.
Yeah. Well, my buddy Tyler let me look through his this year when we were over in Oregon, and it might be worth some of the money. So they're pretty gnarly.
So I wanted to circle back to something that I should have touched it earlier, and I was thinking about it, and I just kept on moving right along. So when you were talking about your calling setup and when you're trying to bring in bulls or whatever, do you have a go-to calling sequence that you use?
For me, it really depends on what the elk are already doing. So, like, I see a ton of questions lately this past week or two, like, the elk aren't talking. What do I do? What do I do? So if it's early season, I'm going to start off hitting an area by bugling into every canyon. And if they're not going to answer, then, you gotta adapt and overcome. So the last couple of years, what I've been doing as far as early season goes, we're getting into that kind of mid pre-rut right now, so it'll be a little different, but just trying to get close to where I think some elk are bedded down. And that can be, based on just seeing fresh sign and trails in and out of stuff, or if you're watching them or what, but get within a few hundred yards and just start kicking around, making soft social elk, cow calls, calf sounds, just mewing. And I'll just try to escalate things from there. Start off real quiet. That way, if anything's closer than you thought, you're not blowing them out of there. But then I'll start, start getting a little higher pitch, a little higher intensity, start throwing in some cow sounds that kind of sound irritated, the whinier stuff. And then I kind of try to paint a picture that there's a few cows in there and maybe a younger satellite bull is just kind of, hooking them around and pestering them, and they don't want any part of it. So I'll start raking a little bit, and a chuckle here and there, or a grunt, and snap a few twigs, rolling rocks around. That really seems to do the trick the last opening weekend, the last few years. The key is once, to be able to repeat that, do it 5-10 minutes at a time, and then sit still and just listen and watch for 10 minutes and then start it back up again. So I'll do that, just that 10-minute cycle for an hour and then just sit.
And then when you start it back up again, do you move 20, 30 yards or is it,
nope,
do you do it right there?
I stay right in the same spot.
Okay, cool.
So the setup where you're doing it is key though. Cause what the mistake I used to make a lot of times was letting elk get into a spot where they could see me before I had a shot at them, which I think is what a lot of new elk hunters do. And it's why bulls hang up, because if they can see where there's supposed to be elk and there's not elk there, they're not going to come check it out any farther. So like this year we were on this pretty steep hillside, but we were tucked right up against this hill on a bench where an elk would have to come right up, 20 or 30 yards before he could see up over the lip of this hill to see what was on that flat spot. And that's exactly what this bull did, came straight up the hill. And I was standing on the edge looking down and saw him come walking up the hill before he saw me. So your setup is key, having the wind right, being in the spot where you've got to be able to have a shooting window at them before they see where you're calling from.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. Watch the wind, watch that those shooting lanes and all that stuff. So
be in front of something, not behind it.
Yeah.
That's another big one, which I'm sure everybody's heard before, but it's real easy when you get excited to jump behind a tree instead of standing out in front of it, you know, your natural reaction is try to conceal yourself. So,
right. Well, before we close this thing up, you got any tips or anything that we didn't touch that you want to share?
Man, put me on the spot.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
I think my biggest takeaway over the last couple of years is having a plan when you get in the woods and sticking to it. You know, even if it's to the point where you have to write it down and say, I'm going to go to this spot for this long. And if it doesn't work, I'm not going to force it. I'm not going to stay there more than 2 days. Then I'm going here, you know, and having spots A, B, C, and D lined out, how much time you plan to spend in them, you know. Because when you get out there and things don't look the way you thought they were, it's easy to get off track and get, you know, you can wind up wandering in the country that you haven't scouted on the map just because maybe you think it's going to look good in person and you're close and, you know, it's easier to walk 2 miles this way than it is to go back to the truck and go somewhere else. So just having a plan and being able to have everything laid out in front of you and maximize the days you have in the woods.
I think that goes
a long way.
I think that's a great takeaway. So on that, let me expand on that a little bit then. When you go out and you pick those spots, how much ground are you covering in the course of a day?
Basically, I'll have a predetermined spot that I want to get to, mm-hmm. to glass from. So it's scouting. I'm trying not to blow through bedding areas and stuff like that. I'll just try to get to a high spot where I can sit and watch what's going on. And I'll spend just a whole day sitting still. It drives me crazy. I hate doing it because I'm not the type to sit still in glass. But if I can, that's really all I'm doing. So if I got to go 4 miles in to get into an area I want to look at, I'll just get in and kind of sit there and just let things happen and try to get a feel for what's going on. So if I'm ridge running new country like I was this year over in Oregon and trying to figure out what's going on and bugling into every canyon, you know, just hunting my way through stuff. We averaged 11 or 12 miles a day. And that's big. That's a lot of ground. So if you don't cover that, I mean, there's country that I cover where 11 and 12 miles a day just isn't doable because the amount of elevation gain and loss you'd have to do would just be insane. So you have to kind of get a feel for what it's smart to do and how much ground you can actually cover. So,
And I'm sure every location is different and it all, you know, terrain dictates how much you can do. So,
yep.
Well, okay, Dan, I appreciate you coming on. If you want, how do people get a hold of you or do you want to be contacted?
Yeah, I don't mind if people have questions or want to talk or, you know, whatever. I've been the new guy trying to figure it out. So I used to, you know, bomb people with messages and that's how you learn. So, I'm on Facebook and Instagram just as Dan Salzman. The Air Force buddy that I was talking about, Spencer, we have a page together called Provider Life. We have, we're putting some films together. We got this year's elk hunt on film and he'll be up in Alaska chasing doll sheep and mountain goats and moose and all types of stuff. So you can check us out there. Social media and the website is Provider Life. So.
Okay. And then will the film be on YouTube?
It will be. Okay. We do have a YouTube channel.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
Good. Well, okay, Dan. I appreciate you coming on again. A lot of great information. And just to hear how you're continually successful, I think that means a lot to new guys that are coming out that get that picture that you really do need to be digging in and you need to be looking at maps and you need to be doing research and it just makes, I mean, I don't know because I haven't done it yet. We'll find out next week when I'm out there, but you know, I think if you're just more comfortable with the area you're going to be in, it's the better potential for success you're going to have.
100% agree. If you invest the time and the effort, you can be successful.
Let's hope so. We'll see how next week goes. So,
well, good luck, buddy.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Thanks, Dan.
You'll do just fine.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
Yeah. Thanks to Dan for coming on the show. I really appreciated having him on here. There was a lot of good information in that, and I certainly appreciated his scouting techniques and just listening to him tell his story about his success in the backcountry. So thanks, Dan. Up next is going to be myself. I'm having Neil back on. If you listen to podcast number 13, Neil's my hunting partner. He's going to be back on, and then we're also going to have Gus Fletcher, who was a third buddy that went with us. He spent the whole week with us out in Colorado chasing elk around the mountains. So I'm going to have those guys on. We're going to wrap up our hunting story, our hunting adventure that we had. Although we weren't successful in getting one on the ground, we had an awesome week. We were into bulls every single day. We heard bulls bugling, chased them around the mountains. We had a good week. I got within 15 yards of a bull that stepped up and put a tree right between myself and him, and there was no shot there. And then, of course, he sniffed us out and took off up the mountain. So, didn't get a shot at him. I'm not going to tell you the whole story now, so I'm going to save it until we get those guys on the show. So, stay tuned. Really cool show coming up with Neil Burge and Gus Fletcher. And I'm looking forward to getting that out there and you guys hearing the story of our hunt. So thanks for listening. And again, thanks to the Sportsman's Nation Network for having us on the show and hosting us on the show. They're able to put out our content for us, and it makes life a lot easier for me going through the Sportsman's Nation podcast network. So thanks, Dan. Thanks to Sportsman's Nation. Thanks to everybody for listening, and can't wait for you guys to listen to this show, and can't wait to get the next one out. So thanks, everybody.